if you've ever undertaken a study of the Reformation in the 16th century, you are very quickly thrown back about 1,100 years to a controversy over grace involving two giants, one Augustine, the other Pelagius, on the issue of grace. What is God's grace? What's man's sinful condition? To really understand the Reformation, you have to go back those 1,100 years to a conversation that began in the 5th century and really was only continuing in the church in the 16th century. We're going to be talking about a 5th century battle over grace here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc. We're back live this Tuesday, November the 28th. We invite your phone calls and your email for the next 3 hours, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. That's the first half hour of the program. In the second, Dr. Sergio Trifkovic will join us to talk about Pope Benedict's visit to a Muslim nation. He's undertaking it right now, Turkey. It is a democracy of sorts and probably the safest place for the Pope to visit, but we'll find out how safe it is for him and what Sergio makes of this visit. The Pope's reason for going is different than what it's turned out to be, and we'll talk about that as well with Dr. Sergio Trifkovic. At 3:45 or so, we're going to start audio open lines. We've got a CBS report on women in Islam and a CNN story on interfaith marriage, a Christian woman and a Muslim man. Apparently, it's not that rare. What do the kids do about it? That's what I wonder about. In the second hour of the program, Dr. Thomas Woodward joins us. He's author of a book, Darwin Strikes Back, Defending the Science of Intelligent Design. Why are evolutionists so up in arms against ID? We'll find out there in the second hour of the program. And then at 4:30, on through the rest of the show today, audio open lines. We started this Tuesday last week when we were last live on the air. Men in Church, a PBS Religion and Ethics Newsweekly report. We're going to pick it up where we left off and get your thoughts on why men aren't in church and what the church is supposed to do about it. A Fox News story on the war on Christmas and a bunch of other audio to play for you in the last hour or so of Issues, Etc. Again, we're back live this Tuesday, November the 28th, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Douglas Johnson is our first guest. He spent 24 years as chairman of the Religion and Philosophy Department at Claflin University in South Carolina. He's author of the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, The Great Jesus Debates, Four Early Church Battles About the Personal Work of Jesus. We come to the fourth major debate in the 5th century. It's a battle over grace. Dr. Johnson, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
My pleasure.
Well, this was a controversy that took place in the 5th century. We'll talk about that, but is it true that this controversy over grace really was an argument that came to fruition 1,100 years later in the 16th century Reformation in the West?
Yes, it certainly was. Luther was one of those persons who looked back to Augustine in support of his views on the primacy of grace. As a matter of fact, he wrote to someone and he was rejoicing that his movement was making progress, and he said, the sign of that is people are reading the Scripture and reading Augustine. So.
Then introduce us to the major players, the two major players in this 5th century debate over grace, beginning with Augustine, and then we'll go on to Pelagius.
Okay, glad to do it. Augustine is so important and so endearing, whether you agree with him or not. We know more about his development than probably any other of the early church fathers because he wrote about it in his classic work, The Confessions, where he, as a bishop, as a Christian bishop, he was looking back to his former pagan lifestyle and his early struggles. And in those struggles, and actually not only as a young pagan, but even as a Christian bishop, there were two things that always seemed to belong together for Augustine. Love and happiness. As a matter of fact, he defines happiness as possessing what you love the most. And as he looks back on his early career, he could see that he should have been loving God most. But he wanted to find his happiness in everything but God, in sex, in career, in friendship, in learning, and so on. And all of it disappointed him. And so he was finally driven to his knees in the Garden of Milan, where he was converted. And as he sees it, he was really worshiping the creature rather than the creator, loving the gift rather than the giver. But God had driven him to the point where he was running from God, but God caught up with him. And this is the confessions, is a confession of sin that he was running from God, and a confession of grace that God came after him as he was a prodigal. But it's good, I think, to look at his development while he was a Christian on the issue of free will and grace. To him, the only thing you have to do to be both happy and good is to love God the most. But he saw that we do not. We love ourselves. We're turned in on ourselves. And so he said, what is the answer to this? As the young Augustine now, we'll see developments, important developments from this. But he says, well, you have a free will, and you've chosen not to love God. Just change your mind and your will and choose to love God. It's as simple as that. Jesus is our exterior teacher, and we can learn from him to look in at ourselves and change. But this view of Augustine, that we have a free will change radically. First of all, he will become priest and then the bishop at Hippo Regis in North Africa. That's why he's called Augustine of Hippo. And he's studying Paul. And as you know, Paul was not very optimistic about human initiative toward God. You know, he said, none is righteous, no, not one. And the law is good, but it can't save us because we can't keep it. And Augustine was evidently also looking at the people as a pastor, and he saw that people can be very ornery. And so he's going to completely change his view and say that here's the human tragedy. The one thing that we need to do to be both happy and good is to love God most, but that is the one thing we cannot do. Since Adam, we have inherited a kind of terminal disease of the human spirit that turns us against God. And here's how I see that he worked it out. In a sense, our will is free. We can make choices, but we only make them based on what already delights us, what we already love. And it's the love that determines the choice, not the other way around. I always like to think of it this way, a little crudely. If your favorite ice cream is, say, chocolate, I can offer you the choice of one of two cones, a chocolate cone or a cockroach and maggot cone. You're free to choose one or the other, but I know what you'll choose because you will choose the one you love the most or delight in the most. And Augustine says it's our delight that's wrong, our love that's wrong, and we can't change it with the will because the will itself is determined by the love. The only way this can be changed is some power comes and breaks through our selfish love and gives us the love of God, and that's grace. It was only by grace that we can be turned to God and be given the love of God. God must take the initiative.
Then who was Pelagius, Augustine's opponent, and how did he differ from Augustine on those very issues that you've talked about, man's nature, free will, and grace?
Okay, Pelagius was evidently a good man. We know very little about him, but he was evidently a pious man who wanted nothing more than to follow his beloved master, Jesus. But he also was a reformer, and he was always calling people to follow this same Jesus. And the one phrase he could not stand was, I can't. I can't stop drinking. I can't do this. I can't do that. Because that pulls the rug out from underneath every attempt at morality. He was always willing to encourage people with, yes, you can. He was a kind of positive thinker, the Norman Vincent Peale of his day. And when you say you can't, he says, you insult your maker. You insult God who gave you a good nature, free will, and reason. And you insult your own nature. Now, he admits that Adam had sinned, and this is passed on to us, but not as it was with Augustine, a kind of inherited disease, but more just a bad example. And there have been plenty of other bad examples added to it. So we think that's our nature, but it's not. And God has countered this by giving us good examples like Job. He has also given us the law, and if we follow it, the image of God in us can shine through. And most of all, he's given us Jesus, who is our example and our teacher. And when we see this example, then with our free will, we can choose to do what God wants us to do. Now, you can notice that this is very much what the earlier Augustine felt, that we have a free will and Jesus is just our teacher. But in his optimism about human nature, Pelagius has no understanding at all of Augustine's view of the very tragic nature of humanity and its disease.
So you can see, folks, here at our halfway point in our conversation with Dr. Douglas Johnson, that the gulf between Augustine and Pelagius could not have been broader. We're going to talk about the controversy a little further here, but we'd also like to hear from you. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. We're back live this Tuesday, the 28th of November, talking about this 5th century battle over grace with the author of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for November, The Great Jesus Debates, Dr. Douglas Johnson. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And that in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, the listeners with the best questions or comments in the next 15 minutes will receive our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, The Great Jesus Debates, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Email us as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. And then in about 15 minutes at the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk with Dr. Sergey Trifkovic about the Pope's visit to Turkey. Dr. Johnson, there's obviously no real way to find a compromise between Augustine and Pelagius. How did the controversy between these two schools of thought go? You talk so much about, it may not have ended well at one point, and then someone takes over, someone gains ascendancy. Who actually, at least at this point in church history, won that debate, Pelagius or Augustine?
Well, officially, Augustine did, because several councils condemned Pelagius. If you will recall, the Council of Ephesus in 431 that condemned Nestorius condemned Pelagius also, probably for the same reason. Pelagius had given too much room and initiative to the humanity of Christ, and Pelagius does the same for us, because for him, it's us that takes the initiative in our own salvation.
Then where does it go from that point? You say officially Augustine won the debate. Is that all there is for Augustine to do to defend his concept of man's fallen nature, the nature of man's will, and the nature of grace?
Well, if I can follow some of the arguments they had, the Pelagians attack Augustine by saying, the Scripture says that we are to make a choice, that we are to turn to God. And Augustine says that's true, but even the turning is given by God. It's God's grace. We couldn't turn without God's grace. Faith itself is a gift. And he uses the Latin for grace is gratis. So he says, if grace or gratia is not gratis, then the very meaning itself is robbed. You cannot use your faith, your turning to God, to merit anything, because it's a gift. The Pelagians then say to him, Jesus himself says his disciples will be rewarded for their works. And he says, yes, but they couldn't do the works without the grace of God. And so by rewarding them, he's crowning his own gifts, he says. And then he scolds them and says, by denying the disease of the human spirit, by denying the disease, you deprive people of the physician who is Jesus. Because our main problem, he too believes Jesus is our teacher, but our main problem is not ignorance, it's a deep illness, and so we need the physician who is Jesus Christ.
How would you respond to some who argue that before Augustine, no church father held Augustine's view, what would be Augustine's view, a low view of man's fallen nature?
Yeah, there's a lot of differences within the fathers on this. I mean, if you go back way to Irenaeus, for instance, he was willing to say that we preserve our free will and reason, but he also says we lost the likeness to God and can't get it back with Christ. So although there are differences, and it's clear Augustine is more severe in looking at the fallen nature of humanity than the Eastern fathers are, there's still with just about all of them, the absolute need to rely in some way or another on the work of Christ and on his Spirit rather than on ourselves.
A couple more questions here, Dr. Johnson. Augustine is also well known for his thoughts on predestination. What were those views, and how did they relate to everything we've been discussing up to this point?
Okay. That is one that people get entangled with and have been getting entangled with seemingly forever. But for Augustine, the belief in predestination is not something to scare little children or feeble-minded or something. It is a direct result of his doctrine of grace, because you have to see it one way or the other. And that is, either God saves us or we save ourselves. And if you say, well, I responded to God and that's what saved me, that means you're saving yourself. And so for him, our salvation comes from God, and because of that, and by the way, this was true of Luther and Calvin as well, we must say God is the one who does it, and that's predestination. Now, in theological circles, they try to draw a distinction between double and single predestination. Double predestination says, God says, I'll send this one to hell and this one to heaven. There's none of that in Augustine. Augustine is what we call single predestination. That is, if we go to hell, we send ourselves there. And God in his mercy plucks some out of that. And he says to his opponents, why do you question God's mercy? Because he could let all of us perish. And the way I put it, these are my words, but I think it captures Augustine's thought, that if we wake up and find ourselves in hell, we have no one to blame but ourselves. And if we wake up and find ourselves in heaven, we have no one to thank but God. And he constantly says, you know, what do you have that you have not received? So predestination is just the logical outcome of his insistence that from beginning to end, Alpha and Omega, it is God who saves us. It is his decision that saves us and not our own.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address issues, etc@kfuo.org. Stephen St. Louis writes this via the email, could you have your guests talk about semi-Pelagianism, Arminianism, and the current belief that one can make a decision for Christ? I believe that we continue to fight the battle against Pelagianism since we all want to add to our salvation. Your thoughts there?
Good question, very relevant question, because even those in the Middle Ages who felt they were good Augustinians wanted him with the rough edges taken off. They said, you must do something, you know, there must be some human initiative here. And of course, Augustine agreed that you must turn to God, but even your turning is a gift of God. And I think the question is pertinent because I suspect if you go into the pews of many of our churches, and maybe even with the preachers, you'll find a lot of at least what's called semi-Pelagianism, that people cannot quite accept that they must rely entirely on God for their salvation.
Could you put it in a nutshell for us? How does the issue of salvation come to a point here in this 5th century, an ongoing controversy over grace, Dr. Johnson?
How do you mean that?
Well, if you could, put a fine point on it. What was really at stake in this controversy between Augustine and Pelagius, and as it continues, as our emailer Steve pointed out,
is the human being capable of his or her own salvation by his or her own efforts, goodness, learning, piety, or whatever? Or is there something seriously wrong, empirically wrong, Augustine would say, with human nature, a disease that affects us all, so that we must rely entirely on God for our salvation?
Then finally, I think Thursday we're going to be talking with you again, wrapping up our final conversation on the book that you've written, The Great Jesus Debates. We're going to be, as you say, looking backward. What can we expect in our conversation on Thursday?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of chapters on looking backward and then also on sort of defending these early fathers. And what I try to do is I hope that as people have been reading or listening, they will see the relevance of what was going on to today and their own lives. But I particularly like to, if I can, draw these things clearly into the open so that people will be able to see more clearly what they might have missed, and that is how all of this really is relevant today and affects us.
Dr. Douglas Johnson spent 24 years as chairman of the Religion and Philosophy Department at Claflin University in South Carolina. He's author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November, The Great Jesus Debates, Four Early Church Battles About the Person and Work of Jesus. Thursday this week, we're going to be wrapping up our conversations with him. Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November. This is a great primer. When Jeff, the producer of the program, first introduced me to this book, he said, "This is a marvelous book." Approaching it as a layperson, says, "I'm reading this. I'm actually understanding in depth that for the very first time some of these debates that I've heard about years after years here on Issues, Etc." Now, if it all kind of becomes alphabet soup for you, and you've wondered, can't tell Pelagius from Augustine or Athanasius from Arius, this is the book for you. The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November, The Great Jesus Debates, Four Early Church Battles About the Person and Work of Jesus. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling, and you can browse before you buy right there at our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book there and some details, a link to a way that you can get the book, or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. You got 90 minutes to do so today. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040 and ask for The Great Jesus Debates, The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November. Well, when we come back from this break, Dr. Serge Trifkovic is going to be our guest. We're going to be talking to him about the Pope's visit to Turkey. It was just going to be a visit to Turkey, saying hello to the leaders there, but the Pope's main purpose was to build a bridge with Orthodox leaders. The Eastern Orthodox leaders there, his fellows in Christendom. What it turned into after what would have been an obscure speech in his home country of Germany is a diplomatic nightmare, but the Pope has gone nonetheless to Turkey under very heavy security, and he's had to do more than simply fulfill the plans that he had at first. We're going to be talking about some of that with Serge Trifkovic when we come back from this break. Then audio open lines at 3:45 at the 4 o'clock mark. We'll be talking with Dr. Thomas Woodward about intelligent design. Why have evolutionists pulled out all the knives, the guns, even the big guns, against intelligent design? What's the big threat? It makes such a modest proposal. Then audio open lines for the remainder of the program. Tomorrow, we'll visit with the author of a new book called The Gospel According to Dan Brown. And we'll also talk with Jennifer Roback Morse about the rise in unwed mothers. More and more children, 4 in 10. Are born out of wedlock. We'll find out why that is and what can be done about it tomorrow when we talk with Jennifer Roback Morse on Issues, Etc. When we come back, the Pope is in Turkey, and he is doing his best to deal with the populace of that country. This is the most friendly Islamic country to the West. They want membership in the European Union. They're so friendly to the West. And they're not happy about the Pope, even though the Pope supports their entrance into the European Union. Serge Trifkovic is next.
Grace, faith, scripture, and Christ alone. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Today, many Christians are interested in the Bible and in current events, but with nothing in between. What's the danger of the church's collective amnesia about its own history? How does a better understanding of church history and the controversies over the person and work of Christ give us a deeper understanding into what Scripture itself teaches about Jesus, our Savior? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November is called The Great Jesus Debates, Four Early Church Battles About the Person and Work of Jesus. For more information about The Great Jesus Debates, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, The Great Jesus Debates by Dr. Douglas Johnson.
The old adage that a picture is worth a thousand words certainly applies to ultrasound images of unborn babies.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Ultrasounds are amazing diagnostic tools that provide medical personnel a glimpse of the moving, yawning, finger-sucking, and sometimes smiling child while still in the womb. Many pregnancy resource centers offer free ultrasounds to women in need, but abortion clinics do not. And radical abortion advocates even oppose giving grants to aid pregnancy resource centers in the purchase of these essential medical devices. We'll tell you more next time.
Are you pro-life? Then visit our website at sba-list.org and discover how you can make a difference. I'm Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Thanks for taking a stand.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Here's a simple quiz to see what you know about the Bible. Keep track of how many you don't get right. Name the children of Adam and Eve. Cain, Abel, and Seth. After the death of what king did Israel split into two nations, north and south? King Solomon. How many books in the Old Testament? 39. What book in the New Testament tells the Christmas story? Luke. Where do you find the golden rule? Matthew 7:12. Who replaced Judas as an apostle? Matthias. What famous thing happened on the road to Damascus? Paul's conversion. The book of Acts ends with Paul arriving in what city? Rome. Now, how many of those questions did you answer correctly? By the way, those are not difficult Doctor of Theology questions. Thinking about the questions you didn't know, answer this. Have you lost your confidence in the Bible? Jesus says in Mark 13:31, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. The real question is, have you lost your confidence in Jesus? I'm Dale Meyer. Thanks for thinking.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkham. We're back here live this week after the Thanksgiving holiday. It's Tuesday, the 28th of November. We invite your questions and your comments as we continue the conversation. Dr. Serge Trifkovic will join us here in just a few minutes after we hear from CNN on the Pope's visit to Turkey. We're going to be talking about that historic visit. It's huge, but it's been made more complicated by recent utterances of the Pope and the reaction in the Islamic world. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. By the way, Steve emailed us in that conversation with Dr. Johnson. Steve, email us back with your information. I'm going to send you a copy of The Great Jesus Debates for Early Church Battles about the person and work of Jesus. Before we talk with Dr. Serge Trifkovic, let's hear from CNN to get the basic facts on the Pope's visit to the Islamic country of Turkey.
It was only in the hours leading up to Pope Benedict's arrival that Turkey's prime minister even agreed to a meeting. It was brief, but like Turkey's famous apostle St. Paul, Pope Benedict delivered a strong message. The Vatican will support Turkey's entry into the European Union. Before becoming pope, he was against accepting a predominantly Muslim country. Benedict's about-face may help to quell the anger behind the violent protests before his visit. Millions of Muslims are enraged over comments the Pope made in September. He quoted a 14th century scholar who described Islam as a violent religion.
The Pope can't insult our sacred prophet and just stroll into this country.
Further protests are banned during the Pope's trip, a trip that will take him to the fabled Blue Mosque, only the second pontiff ever to visit.
It's going to take all his skills, not just as a religious figure, but as a diplomat, to make this work.
The Fuhrer is still so great, the Pope will have unprecedented security. Snipers are in place, 15,000 police are on duty, and he may even wear a bulletproof vest under his papal robes.
This trip was planned before Pope Benedict made his comments. The original aim was to meet with the leader of the Orthodox Church in Turkey. Pope Benedict has said one of his long-term goals is to gather all Christians into a united body. Gloria Riviera, ABC News, London.
Dr. Serge Trifkovic joins us now. We're going to talk about the Pope's visit to Turkey. He's foreign affairs editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and he's director of the Rockford Institute Center for International Affairs. Sergio, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you again, Todd.
Well, has the Pope's purpose for going to Turkey changed in spite of what he wants to be there for? Has it changed beyond his ability to do anything about it?
First of all, let's be clear on one point. It was the Turkish government that dictated the framework and the status of his visit. His original intention had been to pay a purely pastoral visit to the Patriarch Bartholomew of the Ecumenical Patriarch, and not to have a state visit, even not to visit Ankara at all. But what your listeners ought to realize is that the Turks, even though nominally secular, are treating the Orthodox Patriarch in Constantinople as an obedient subject, and he doesn't have much say in the matter. And what they've done is the equivalent of, for instance, the Italian Republic telling the leader of the Anglican Church that he cannot come to the Vatican and visit the Pope unless he agrees that his visit is to be a fully-blown state visit to Italy. That will include visits to the President of the Republic and the Prime Minister and the laying of the wreath at the tomb of King Emmanuel.
Okay, so in other words, what you're saying here is the big story here is that the political leaders in Turkey are dictating the Pope's terms for why he's visiting and what he's going to do there?
Absolutely, and this is, again, something that is too delicate for the Pope to hint at, or indeed the Vatican bureaucracy, and something that is quite well known, quite obvious, and yet seems to elude the attention of countless commentators and scribes and talking heads. What we are looking at is Turkey, a nominally secular country, abusing its position of physical control over the Orthodox Patriarchate of Constantinople and using it as a means of effectively forcing the Pope to convert a visit that had been originally intended to be pastoral into a state occasion. And furthermore, obviously, with his latest statements, there was a pound of flesh to be extracted on the account of his Regensburg address and his earlier statements that clearly indicated that he did not support Turkey's joining the European community, or rather the European Union. On both accounts, I do not believe that the Pope is being exactly sincere, but he was obviously between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, if he cancels the visit, that will harm the position of the Christians in Turkey, who are already under immense pressure. And on the other hand, if he goes along with it, he will have to make all the politically correct statements that Recep Tayyip Erdogan and others are expecting. I think it's very unfortunate that the Pope chose the second course, because I do not think that Turkey belongs to the European Union. In fact, one could be cynical and say that the only reason why it should join is to bring about the end of that unpleasant institution, because it will be subjected to all kinds of internal pressures that can no longer be accommodated. But it is particularly the Pope's statements about the peaceful and loving nature of Islam that are not only at odds with his Regensburg address, and mind you, he was only quoting Emperor Emmanuel, he didn't express his own views, but it is clear that this is effectively something done under duress.
You have mentioned several times that ostensibly Turkey is a secular state. Do you foresee Turkey moving toward becoming an officially Islamic state anytime in the near future, Sergio?
If you remember the Shah, he looked fairly solid and inviolable in his position of more or less absolute power in Iran throughout the 1970s. And it was only in the last year of his rule that things suddenly started going downwards. So I believe that Iran in 1975-76 corresponded to where Turkey is today, 3 to 4 years away from an Islamic wave that is already sweeping the country, but that is not yet apparent at the top of the political pyramid. Turkey's elite class is rather narrow. It comprises many wonderful Western-educated people with highly developed sensibility, notably the Nobel Prize winner for Literature, Orhan Pamuk, and many other Turks of undoubtedly European tastes and the desire to act as the bridge between two cultures and two continents. But by and large, it is an overwhelmingly Muslim society, and the feelings of the Turks are well manifested in the fact that they've elected the party of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is now termed post-Islamist, but who hasn't given up on any of the tenets of his political creed. And what is particularly worrying is that for the first time, the junior ranks of the Turkish army are being affected by the Islamist tendencies, and the army is widely regarded as the only bulwark of the legacy of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the reformer who, back in the 1920s, turned the Ottoman Empire into a secular nation state.
Two final questions for you, Sergio. Turkey is reported to be the friendliest Islamic nation, that is, nation with predominantly an Islamic population, to the West. Is that a deserved reputation?
Not at all. If you look at the actual sentiments of ordinary Turks, they're very well reflected in the most popular movie ever made in Turkey. It's called Valley of the Wolves, Iraq. And it concerns a largely fictitious account of a firefight between a Turkish contingent of peacekeepers and an American Marine unit. It is very loosely based on fact that it was a matter of mistaken identity. But it is a film in which evil Americans deliberately shoot guests, civilian guests, at a wedding party, including a little boy, and where they kidnap Iraqis to extract their body organs and sell them on the black market in New York and significantly Tel Aviv. Turkey is also a country where a Westerner can feel relatively safe and relatively comfortable in Istanbul and along the Aegean coast, when the Kurds are not blowing themselves up during the tourist season. But if you go into the heartland of Anatolia, and if you go to the eastern part of Turkey, even the U.S. personnel at Isfahan Air Force Base have to travel in convoys and carry arms with them, because unlike back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, it is no longer safe for them to wander around on their own. Last but by no means least, let's also remember that Turkey has regional ambitions that far exceed the appetites of a regular secular country, most notably in the Aegean, where it has constant territorial disputes with the Greeks. And also Turkey actively occupied the northern two-thirds of Cyprus, an independent and sovereign country, in an act of wanton military aggression for which it had never been properly reprimanded, let alone punished, either by NATO or by Washington, D.C. And also Turkey has further geopolitical designs in the former Soviet Central Asia, in countries such as Tajikistan, Turkmenia, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan, all of which are ethnically and linguistically related to the Turks. So what we are witnessing is a regional power of the first order in the making that has every reason to mimic the language of modern secularism in its PR, but which in essence is both culturally and spiritually and politically and ethnically vastly different from the rest of Europe, not only vastly different, but also potentially inimical to it.
Well, then, finally, are you comforted at all that, at least in its outward political form, Turkey remains a democracy.
Well, Turkey remains a democracy in the sense in which Iraq is turning into a democracy, a largely Islamic theocracy in which the institutions of political Islam are being re-legitimized. What is happening in Turkey is that under the democratic veneer, you are witnessing the erosion of Kemalist institutions and the gradual return of the Islamic mindset that dominated the Ottoman period. And it is very much in line with the phenomenon of what is called democracy in the greater Middle East. We witnessed it in Algeria, where the army had to intervene in 1994 to prevent the Islamists from coming from power. We saw it in the Palestinian Authority, where Hamas was victorious in a democratic election. And, of course, exactly a year ago, when President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt allowed the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwanis, to contest elections, in every constituency where they fielded candidates, they swept the board. So, yes, Turkey is very much a democracy in the spirit of the Islamic Greater Middle East.
Dr. Sergey Trifkovic is foreign affairs editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. He's director of the Rockford Institute Center for International Affairs. Sergey, thank you for your time and thank you for your thoughts on the Pope's visit to Turkey. I imagine we'll want you back to talk about it when the Pope has concluded his mission there. Thank you very much for being our guest.
It's my pleasure to be with you as always, and I'm sorry if my assessment is not exactly brightening your listeners' afternoon.
Well, I'd rather have realistic than unrealistic. Dr. Sergey Trifkovic. Well, for the remainder of this hour and on into the next, just for the remainder of this hour, we've got some audio open lines for your questions and your comments. Picking up on where we left off there with Sergey, there's a CBS report on women in Islam. It's a bit of a PR push to try, because this is where the rubber hits the road with Islam in the West. What we see is women walking around in burqas, of course, in France and in Great Britain. They're dealing with this as a political issue. They see it as a failure of the Islamic people, devout Islamic people, to integrate into the various countries in the United States. That show is certainly coming to a theater near you. Here's a CBS report on women in Islam.
It's no secret that Muslims in America have a public relations problem. The impression by many non-Muslims that Islam encourages violence.
Assalamu alaikum.
So the newly elected head of one of the largest Islamic organizations in North America may be a revelation, a gentle, scholarly Canadian convert to Islam named Ingrid Mattson.
Why do we pick out only those Muslims who are acting violently?
It's almost a rhetorical question because Mattson knows the violent acts seize headlines. From the September 11th attacks to suicide bombers in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Whoever insults the Prophet, kill him!
To riots earlier this year against publication of Danish cartoons and, more recently, reaction to the Pope's comments about the Prophet Muhammad.
These people are not motivated by their religious belief. They use their religious beliefs to justify their actions.
But that explanation doesn't appear to be convincing to many Americans. A CBS poll shows only 19% have a favorable opinion of Islam, 45% unfavorable.
You've talked about something called Muslim fatigue. What is Muslim fatigue?
There are Americans who are simply tired of hearing that Islam is a peaceful religion, that Muslims are nice people. They don't want to hear us saying that. They want us to do something. Do something about these problems.
Mattson insists Muslims do cooperate with authorities and that they reject violent extremists.
The problem with this way of looking at things is that, first of all, it puts the burden of the responsibility of doing something about terrorism on the Muslim community.
Well, is it that where it should lie?
In terms of clarifying the Islamic position, but we're not the intelligence community, we're not the police force, we're not the government.
At times a defender, at other times a conciliator for her adopted religion, Mattson hopes to bring America a new view of Islam. If only the extremists cooperate. Randall Pinkston, CBS News, Hartford.
It's audio open lines. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us here during audio open lines as we come to you live the 28th of November. It's Tuesday, and we're back live after the holiday weekend. IssuesETC@KFUO.org. IssuesETC@KFUO.org. Well, that's an ongoing story, the attempt to defend Islam in the West from what happens in Islamic countries in the rest of the world and the reputation it tends to gain. Here is an angle that I hadn't thought about. And if you would have asked me, hey, what about Christians and Muslims married to one another? It's not unusual to run across Christians of various stripes married to one another, or even Christians with non-Christians. That's not unusual at all. Interfaith or mixed marriages almost sounds quaint, doesn't it? Because nowadays, you're supposed to marry who you fall in love with, not someone who shares your same religious convictions. Here's a CNN story on interfaith marriage, and it has to do with a Christian woman married to a Muslim man. I'd like your thoughts on it when we're done with this audio. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Ahmad and Flora Awadallah have been happily married for 25 years, but both say when it comes to their faith, they've never been on the same page. Literally.
He doesn't even start on the same side of the page as I do. When we read left to right, right to left.
Ahmad's book of worship is the Quran. He's a dedicated Muslim who prays five times a day. His wife, Flora, reads the Bible. She's a church-going Christian.
I truly believe in my religion. You know, I truly believe that Jesus is my Savior. So if I believe that, I can't just go change my mind.
As a man, as a Muslim, you like your wife to be a Muslim, the same thing, the same religion that's my religion.
According to a recent survey, Ahmad Awadallah is among 21% of Muslims in the United States living in a mixed religion household. There are a number of internet support groups offering advice on how to make interfaith marriages work. The Awadallahs say their marriage has lasted for several reasons. Love, compromise, and not converting to the other's faith.
I'd have to have a real radical reason to convert. I would have to truly believe in Islam to convert to it. I wouldn't just convert to make him happy.
As for compromise, Flora Awadallah, in keeping with Islamic tradition, gave up alcohol and eating pork.
I had to give up pepperoni.
Oh, yes.
The couple has three children, two daughters, 11 and 17, and a son, who's 19. They go to church.
Oh, I'd be thrilled if they were Christians.
And they study Islam.
To me, they are Muslims.
Do you think about whether you're Muslim or Christian or both, or how do you identify yourself? Well, or do you?
I don't know. I kind of take things from both and just put it together, just combine it into one super religion.
My father wants me to marry a Muslim, or my mom wants me to marry a Christian, but, like, right now, I'm only 17.
Marriage counselors say one of the biggest problems facing Muslim-Christian couples is raising children. The Awadallahs say regardless of who their children worship, they'll support them, just as they have each other. Jason Carroll, CNN, New York.
You know, I guess that the old model used to be that find someone, let's say you're a Christian, find someone who is actually of the same Christian denomination and of the same convictions, and that's the person you marry. And then, if you couldn't do that, you'd find someone of the same Christian denomination and hope to convert them to your denomination. This still happens a lot. You know, a Baptist will marry a Roman Catholic and the Roman Catholic will become a Baptist, or the other way around. But more and more, it's, at least among Christians, it's considered normal to have a person of one denomination and another and neither compromise at all. They might split their Sundays between two churches. And now, interfaith marriages in the broadest sense, that is, a Christian woman married to a Muslim man. Do you think, this is my question for you, we've only got a minute or two here before we go to our break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org. Do you think it's certainly possible to do this? This couple has proven that it's possible, but do you think it's possible to do it without such compromise, especially with the raising of your children, that you couldn't do it and be a Christian, or you couldn't do it and be a Muslim consistently? What did the kids opt for, at least the son? He opted for the worst possible compromise. He takes a little bit of mom's faith, Christianity, a little bit of dad's religion, Islam, puts them together in what he calls his own super religion. That's an unacceptable compromise. Let's see what Alan has to say, calling from Maryland Heights. Alan, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd, how are you?
I'm doing well.
I think the most telling thing in that piece is what I've been dealing with some of my friends and coworkers, is the children. You have a Muslim father and a Christian mother, and the kids are nothing.
Or a strange hybrid of the two, which turns out to be a religion of the, yeah, nothing, or a religion of their own invention.
Right.
Do you think it's possible, well, not possible, do you think that a Christian can do it without compromising their own faith completely?
Well, I think it comes down to the children again, and the Bible says don't be unequally yoked, so just don't do it. I'm a Presbyterian, and I broke up with my girlfriend last year because she was a Baptist, and I didn't think it was a good idea.
Alan, thank you very much for the call. Sorry to hear about the girlfriend. Hope you find another one. Presbyterian, preferably. You know, I'm a Lutheran, and I guess I never thought about marrying someone who wasn't a Lutheran. But then I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy. Yeah, Paul says don't be unequally yoked with the unbeliever. I don't know if Paul would have even imagined, say, marrying someone who was a thorough pagan on purpose. But he certainly provided for the possibility that Christians would become, people would become Christians, and that the spouse would be unbelieving. Not an atheist, but in that case, a pagan. Christians and Muslims married to one another, and then saying, look, we're both going to stay in our own corner on this religion issue, and we'll let the kids duke it out in between. And they'll get to decide what they're going to be. And I guess if the kids decide to be Christo-Muslims or Islamo-Christians or whatever they want to be, I guess that's fine. Now, that might be a recipe for marital and familial bliss, or at least truce. But what Christian would want their kid to be half-Muslim, half-Christian, which is neither of either? Or what Muslim would want their kid to grow up half-Christian, half-Muslim, which is neither of either? Betty's on the line from Lake St. Louis. Betty, our time is very short. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, if you believe Jesus is the only way to salvation, I don't see how you could possibly marry a Muslim and have your children not raised in the Christian faith. Or even knowing that your husband might not be saved. I just don't, I mean, either you don't understand the Christian faith or it's not important to you.
Betty, thank you very much for the call. Well, you know, nowadays we're being told by people within and without the church that our faith ought to be so completely, so intensely a private thing that it shouldn't really make any difference. Now, the question isn't whether it's possible to live, to have a marriage that's happy or have a family that's happy. The question is whether or not this isn't detrimental to everyone's faith. Could you marry, as a Christian, could you marry someone and not expect them to adopt your faith, to continue throughout your life of marriage, to witness to them in the hopes that they would believe in Jesus Christ? I don't think so.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Christianity in a Pagan World, Lessons from Ancient Israel and Early Christianity, and Confessional Lutheranism in the Ecumenical World are the themes for the annual symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. This year's symposia begin January 16th and end on January 19th. Now, for a complete list of speakers, symposia schedule, or to register online, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call 260-452-2241, 260-452-2241. The fellowship alone is worth the registration fee, and you can experience the Christ-centered, cross-focused worship life at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. It's the 2006 Symposia Series, January 16th through the 19th at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. For more information, issuesetc.org or call 260-452-2241.
Peace Lutheran Church, your church of the week on AM 850 KFUO Clayton, St. Louis, invites you to join us Sunday afternoon, December 10th, for our annual German Advent Christmas service.